This is the universe. Big, isn't it? Thousands of suns, myriads of stars, separated by immense distances and by thin floating clouds of gas. The starlight makes the gas transparent, and where there are no stars, it appears as dark, obscuring clouds, like that great black cone over there. Hello, there's a nova. A whole solar system exploded. Someone must have been messing about with the uranium atom. No, it's not our solar system, I'm glad to say. Ah, those are called a globular cluster of stars. Rather fine. Down here in the right-hand corner, see that little chap rather like a Boy Scout's badge? It's a mass of gas expanding at thousands of cubic miles a minute. Ah, here we are. We're getting nearer home. The moon, our moon, in the first quarter. And here's the Earth, our Earth. Moving around in its place, part of the pattern, part of the universe. Reassuring, isn't it? It's night over Europe, the night of the 2nd of May, 1945. That point of fire is a burning city. It had a 1,000 bomber raid an hour ago. Here, rolling in over the Atlantic, is a real English fog. I hope all our aircraft got home safely. Even the big ships sound frightened. Listen to all the noises in the air.
This was their final tower.
Listen.
A Matter of Life and Death, released in the United States as Stairway to Heaven, is a 1946 fantasy film directed by the respected team of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. It stars David Niven as an RAF pilot whose crew is killed while on a bombing run. His plane is on fire and about to crash. He communicates to an American radio operator named June, played by Kim Hunter. In his final moments, they forge a real connection. Not wanting to die in the crash and having no available parachute, Niven's Peter Carter jumps from the plane to his surefire death. Except, that's not what happens. Carter wakes up on a beach, wondering how he survived the fall. He then runs into June, and they eventually fall in love. We then learn that due to heavy cloud cover, the angel responsible for bringing Peter to the afterlife messed up and missed him, and allowed Peter to slip through the system, returning to Earth. While he undergoes a series of examinations by a doctor, played by Roger Livesey, the agents of the afterlife put Peter on trial to determine whether he should be allowed to stay among the living or be called home. So this is a wonderful little movie, and it's relatively obscure. So when I got a communication from Mark Lax to talk about movies he wanted to discuss, he mentioned this film, and I was so charmed by that because I didn't know anyone else that had seen it that I thought it would be perfect to have him on to talk about it. So, you know, Mark, you know, like, what's your history with this movie? When did you see it, and why was it on your list of things you wanted to talk about?
Well, I remember the first time I saw it, I was at my grandparents, and I remember the name Stairway. It was Stairway to Heaven when it was on back then.
Right.
I was maybe, I don't know, maybe I was 10. And I just, you know, because of the song Stairway to Heaven, I was curious, what's this movie about? It can't be Led Zeppelin. And we watched this movie, and I was just kind of, I was fascinated, you know, by this story. You know, the whole idea, you know, about the angel of death missing him and you know, he lands in the water. And then, of course, the whole story of, is it in his head? Because he supposedly has his brain injury. Is this actually happening? I remember the moments. I remember when they showed Heaven, and Heaven was in black and white. And at the time, you know, I thought, well, you would think Heaven would be more colorful. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be the fantasy sequence, and then Earth maybe that would be the black and white. And it seemed to make sense. And now looking back on it, if in fact he is dreaming this, if in fact he's thinking of his friend up in heaven checking in and all of that. You know, they say we dream in black and white. I don't know if that's true. Whether that was something that Powell and Pressburger were thinking of, I don't know. I remember the first thing that struck me was in the beginning of the movie when he lands on the beach and he finds that naked kid sitting there on the beach. And I was like, wait a minute, this movie was 1946? There's a naked kid sitting there. But I just thought it was just so clever the way it was done, because it's almost like a little puzzle, because, you know, you don't know, again, is this going on through his head or is it really happening? One of the funny things, you know, because they do say a lot of times when people have a brain injury or something, they could smell something. There's a scent. And, you know, Dr. Reeves asks him, do you smell anything? He said, yes. He said, is it pleasant? And he says, yes. And he says, well, what is it? He says, fried onions. And I said, that's interesting. You know, it sort of puts, it's another little clue as to whether it's real or not. Only because, you know, it sounds like something that someone with a brain injury might actually smell something like that. You know, you'd figure he'd say, oh, I smell flowers or I smell perfume, you know, but no, he smells fried onions. And I just thought that was just something else. It was like, okay, maybe he really has, you know, this brain injury. And the scene where they're playing ping pong and it, you know, Kim Hunter and Roger Leslie are playing ping pong, and, you know, it freezes because the Angel of Death comes, and he's supposed to ring the bell when he sees the Angel of Death, and of course he can't because the Angel of Death stops it. That whole moment, especially the moment with the book, you know, the book of chess.
Right, the book that keeps disappearing, yeah.
Right, right. And he, you know, and he take, and the Angel of Death, you know, seems to take the book, and then he goes away, and then everything goes back to normal, and he rings the bell, and they run in, and, you know, and he says, oh, he tricked us, didn't he? So then watching how they just kind of go back and forth, because then the next thing I think we see with him and the Angel of Death is when they're on the stairway going up to heaven, and they're discussing, you know, because he's going on trial to save his life. You know, why should his life be saved? The Angel of Death missed him, but he came down to get him, and he said, no, he's in love. And he said, I want a trial. I want a fight for my life. So they're going up on the steps, going up towards heaven, and they're looking at, I don't know, Aristotle and Plato and I think even Abraham Lincoln, and they're trying to think of someone who could defend him, you know, up in heaven. And of course, as they're discussing this, the stairway goes farther and farther up, and he kind of realizes that he might be caught. So he runs down. But then the character, the way they set it up is kind of clever. The character, Dr. Reeves, Roger Livesley, who he was a well-known British actor. The one thing I remember is the first time we see him, he's looking at the village.
Oh, and this crazy viewfinder he's got.
Yes. And I'm like, wow, that was just so clever, you know. He's just looking at the village, and, you know, he's seeing everything that's going on. And then, you know, of course, Kim Hunter's character comes to him and tells him all about Peter, David Niven's character. And so, you know, right from the start, he's there trying to help him. And, you know, he seems to believe that Peter believes what he's seeing, but he doesn't really truly believe that, you know, the Angel of Death is just coming to take him. But he keeps telling him, Peter keeps telling him as things progress, that, okay, the trial is tonight, and they pick someone, you know, from the prosecutor. And so,
is the prosecutor is the first British soldier killed in the American Revolution?
Right, the first American killed by a British bullet.
Right, I'm sorry, I got it backwards. Yeah.
So he's the one, you know, who's going to be like the prosecutor. And Reeves knows that things are coming to a head one way or the other because it's getting closer and closer. Okay, the trial is tonight. And, you know, so he's saying, well, okay, that we gotta save his life because, you know, when this trial goes on, if it ends, he dies. If he doesn't, you know, if it doesn't go his way. Well, what happens while Dr. Reeves is on his motorcycle? He's kind of a wild man on that motorcycle.
He's got a cool leather jacket. He is one cool doctor.
He is cool. He really is. And he, I guess, the ambulance, you know, sideswipes him, and he dies. And, of course, he goes up to heaven, and Peter's in the ambulance, and she tells him, Kim Hunter's character tells him that he's died. And that's when he, you know, in his mind, makes up the idea that, okay, he's going to ask for the doctor to be his counsel. And he goes up, the doctor comes up to, I guess he comes up to heaven, and I guess he has his own angel of death or something that's supposed to lead him, but Peter's angel of death stops and says, I'll take him from here, because he knows he's going to be his counsel. And that whole scene at the supposed trial, where they have soldiers from, like, all through time, you know? Like, any soldier that has died and has gone to heaven, you know, they're all come to see this, because this is, like, unprecedented. This is, like, never happened before. So, of course, the whole defense is they have to prove that he loves her. If they could prove he's in love with her, they'll save his life, they'll let him live. So, when they, Brandon Massey, who's kind of, you know, kind of makes more or less a guest appearance in this.
He supposedly, the famous story with him, supposedly, he was such a fan of Powell and Pressburger, because he had done some of their earlier films.
Right.
That they called him and offered him this very small part, and he said, anytime, anywhere.
Right.
For Powell and Pressburger.
And so, you know, he comes in, well, you know, he wants to get this guy. You could tell because he hates the British because, you know, he fought in the Revolutionary War. He was the first guy killed by a British bullet, you know. So he starts his defense against the British and, you know, the whole thing with the radio and, you know, Raymond Massey's character is, you know, trying to say, oh, England is so great, huh, now. So he puts the radio on. You could hear this guy, like, a monotone, like, oh, The game went in overtime, and the score, you know, and he's just droning on, and he's just trying to say, this is what you want to defend? So he said, okay, you want to talk about America today? And the Angel of Death, who's Maurice Goring, I think his name is, who plays the angel, who plays the conductor, I guess they call him.
Yeah, Marius Goring.
Marius
Goring. Hell of a name.
Yeah, now, I had heard that he wanted the role of Peter to play the David Niven role. You know, I'm not that familiar with him as an actor. I certainly know him from this film. But I found that very interesting. But they said no. They said no. They said, you can play the conductor or that's it. So that's the part he played. But he was wonderful in that part. But then he, you know, he pops in with the radio. And they put the radio on in America. And they're listening to, like, swing music. You know, and he's like, Raymond Massey's like appalled by this music. He's like, I don't even understand what that is. And Dr. Reeves says, you know what? Neither do I, you know. And it's funny because I notice, I guess they have in heaven what we see is the GI section. So all GIs who die, this is where they come. And you could tell the difference between with the British GIs and the American GIs. As soon as the American GIs go up there, they're buying Cokes and they're drinking Cokes and they're, you know.
There's a Coke machine that everybody can just pull Cokes out of.
Right, right. And, of course, the Americans go right to that. And then I remember the scene, I don't know if she's a nurse, angel, whatever she was. You know, she takes Bob, who's his friend, and they look down. I don't know if they're looking down through the heavens, I don't know, but there was these big circles in the ceiling, and you look, you know, they're looking down, I guess towards Earth, And it's just the way that it's, I mean, there's almost like light coming out of these, you know, coming out of these circles that they're, you know, that they're looking through. And there, it was just, to me, I just thought that was very clever, the way that was done. The way that just anybody in heaven can go up to one of these, you know, circles and look down on Earth and see what's going on. And I also notice some of the characters, like when Death, the conductor, when he first tries to explain what's happening, he's talking to this woman who I guess is like the recorder or something for I don't know for heaven or whatever she does, and she, it almost looks like she has a halo. You know, she doesn't, but the lighting, it just almost looks like she has this halo. And I think cinematographer, I think, was Jack Cardiff, who was a really well-known cinematographer.
Yeah, highly respected, yeah.
And it's just, I mean, this whole movie is just beautifully shot. Just absolutely beautiful, from the Technicolor to the black and white, and the way it goes from... The way it'll go from black and white into the color, into the black and white, you know, as opposed to like The Wizard of Oz, where it was black and white, and then you open the door and, ooh, there's the color. This just keeps shifting back and forth. And it's just, I mean, it's just a beautiful film.
Yeah, I mean, I want to give a look. God, there's so much to respond to there, because you mentioned a lot of things.
Yeah.
I want to give a little bit of context in terms of, for people who aren't familiar with Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburg.
Right.
The closest comparison I can make to modern parlance would be these guys were the Coen brothers.
Yes.
Before the Coen brothers.
Yes.
They were two British guys that got, they were not related. They got together and
right.
they started making films together. Basically, Emmerich and Powell worked on the script. Emmerich produced and Powell directed.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a series under the production company Archer Films. They made a series of highly respected, very, very interesting, completely diverse movies.
Right.
Some of their films are The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, Black Narcissus, The Red Shoes, I Know Where I'm Going, A Canterbury Tale, and and of course, A Matter of Life and Death. Not a single one of these movies is like the other. I mean, these things are just so, I mean, they're visually, they're different stylistically, their subject matter, their tone, their length. These guys were incredibly diverse filmmakers, and you know, like Mike Martin Scorsese, who's like, you know, credits them as one of his big inspirations.
Right.
And I mean, this film, right from the very beginning, this film starts in color. The shots of David Niven's character in his plane are really amazingly crisp
oh, yeah.
and beautiful. And there's this hideous close up of one of his fellow pilots who is dead.
I think it's Bob. Yeah, I think the one that's his friend who goes to heaven, I believe.
Right.
Or
oh,
maybe not.
Right.
Or maybe
yeah.
it's some...
You know what it is. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
And there's this big close-up of Bob's corpse as Peter is trying to talk, and it's like you're not used to seeing somebody up that close.
No.
And then we see him talking to Kim Hunter. We cut over to her in this radio tower, and the radio tower that she's in is all glass enclosed, except it has these sort of, you know, kind of like a these little bars of metal that are separating, you know, the panes of glass. And
right.
when certain lighting goes on, they fill with red. The whole background behind her is filled with red, so it gives it this sort of weird spidery type feel. And it is just startling how beautiful this film is. And as you mentioned, when we move up to, I was going to say heaven. They never call it heaven. We know it's heaven, but they imply. Yeah, it shifts to black and white, and we mentioned this stairwell, and the movie, of course, said in the U.S. was called Stairway to Heaven, because apparently U.S. distributors said nobody wants to hear, this was just after the war, nobody wants to see a movie with the word death in the title.
Yes.
So they changed it.
And they said to them, well, you just did a movie called Death Takes a Holiday. And they said, yes, but Death Takes a Holiday, there's no death. So that was their defense of why, you know, it was okay to name that movie Death, but they didn't want to keep the name A Matter of Life and Death.
Yeah, which is, we said, this is why when you first hear about it, you're like, wait, is this Stairway to... What movie is this? This is a different movie. And part of
right.
the reason is, again, the stairwell set that you see up in heaven is
yeah.
absurdly huge and vast. I mean, it is, the sets they built for this film are just completely stunning. And I mean, we see all these extras and all stuff. And you know, you mentioned the whole bit about that we see the soldiers that come right in. There is not a single member of the Axis powers represented in Heaven. There are no Japanese, there are no German, there are no Italians. And the reason we know that is because we hear everyone speaking their native tongue. So we hear people speaking, you know, English. We hear people speaking, you know, like Hindu and Tamil and all these different places. But there is no Axis powers. And that is why some people at the time said this is a propaganda film. Because they're basically saying the Axis powers don't get to go to Heaven. Anyone who fought for the Axis goes somewhere else.
Right.
So right there is kind of an interesting, you know, sort of angle there. And I mean, Heaven is really like this big processing station. There's yes, paperwork, you know, there's the secretary who's, you know, counting people in and out. And it's very interesting that the minute everybody gets to Heaven, they're immediately relaxed. I mean, we see the doctor die and he goes to Heaven like in the next scene and he's not upset.
He's not
disturbed. He's just all happy now. He's like, okay, I guess I'm in Heaven now.
Yeah, the conductor goes, oh, wait, I'll take him because, you know, he's going to be counsel. Oh, well, let's go. You know, everybody just kind of, they're all very cheery. And, you know, so obviously it's, you know, we know it's supposed to be Heaven. They right, never say that. They never use the word.
Right.
And, of course, you know, they also imply that it could all be in his head. But there's certain scenes that I, you know, question, could he have dreamt some of these discussion that's going on in Heaven or whatever? You know, because you can make a case of saying, well, it could all be in his head and everything he's imagining his friend Bob going up there. And, you know, he's thinking, you know, about, oh, the reason he's alive is because the angel of death missed him. And that's why they're, you know, so you could fill in the hole saying, well, he could be imagining all of this. But I think there, you know, one thing that's never explained is that he fell from, what, like 1,000 feet or something without a parachute?
I mean, there's no way he survived that.
No, and he, you know, he's in the water, and it's like, wait a minute, could he really have survived that? And the movie just, you know, it's like I said, almost like a little bit of a puzzle because you're looking at little clues as to, well, you know what? Maybe he is imagining it. Wait a minute. No, I don't think he is. And then, you know, that whole thing with the book, that she, at the, you know, the angel of death has the book. And at the very end, you know, after the decision is made, you know, he says, Peter, don't forget your book. And he throws the book down and she finds it in his jacket, which I don't think it was in his jacket. You know, when, I don't know if it was when, you know, just before he got in the ambulance or whatever. I don't think it was there, and now it was there. And, you know, the whole idea, I mean, the scene where he's being operated on, and she's, Kim Hunter's character is watching, and all of a sudden they freeze because they want, you know, they want to take him up and, you know, have his trial. And she has a tear. And they take the tear to use that as evidence as to the fact that she, you know, he says he's in love with her, she's in love with him. And this shows, you know, because she was crying watching the operation. That whole scene, you know, during the trial, when they have all of these different nationalities, all of these, you know, I guess more ancient warriors from all over the place who are the jury. And they, you know, he feels, I guess Dr. Reeves feels, well, you know what, this isn't fair. You know, you don't have, you know, you don't have the British, you don't have the Americans, you know, represented, you don't. So they switch it to all Americans, but all the Americans are all different nationalities. Similar to all the original jury, but now these are all people who are Americans. They were either born there or they were, you know, became American citizens. you know, and I just found it very interesting how they worked that, you know, because they took the, you know, this jury of all these different nationalities from all through time, I guess, and they decided to get, you know, I assume they wanted the Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? So they say, okay, let's make them American, and they do, but they're all different nationalities, and so they keep, you know, they keep that, but now they're using, you know, more, I guess, modern day Americans instead of these ancient warriors from way back. That scene when they play the radio and they, you know, they listen to the swing music and they don't know what the hell that is. It's just, you know, it's making a case. I had heard that this movie was supposed to be towards American and English relations to try to bring them together a little bit. Again, you mentioned the, you know, propaganda, but supposedly it was supposed to, you know, be like a, you know, the British and the Americans working together.
Right.
And it, you know, it's funny how the, you know, of course, the prosecutor, Reuben Massey, you know, is so anti-British, and yet you could see that while he stays kind of not angry. Of course, he's kind of angry in the beginning, but you know, he doesn't give up his position. But at the same time, you could see at the end when they decide, they all go down the stairs and they bring Kim Hunter and they say, well, if you really love him, you'll take his place. And he's like, no, don't. He, you know, Peter says to her, don't do it. She goes, but I love you. And if it means to keep you alive, I'll do it. And she steps, you know, she gets on the steps and the steps start going up and then it stops. And she runs down, and it shows them that, you know, she, the love that they had for each other, you know, and that was the whole case to prove that he loves her, and that he could stay on Earth,
mm-hmm.
and then they discuss, well, okay, now that he's going to live, we have to discuss when he's going to die, how long he's going to live. And they write down, I guess, either an age or a year or something. And, you know, Dr. Reeves is like, oh, that's, you know, very good. And then Raymond Massey's like, oh, don't you think that's a little too much? You know, and they're like, well, you know, and then he gives it. He goes, oh, okay. And, and of course, we didn't mention the judge. The judge for the trial, he's got the long wig, powdered wig or whatever. And, you know, he's presiding over this trial. And at the end of the movie, when the surgery is done and he lives through the surgery, the doctor takes off the mask.
Right.
It's the judge.
It's the same Abraham Sofar.
Sofar, yeah.
Sofar, yeah. Yeah, it's the same actor, yeah. I mean, this movie does seem to go back and forth about whether, you know, like I said, is this really happening? I mean, since there's no way he could have survived jumping out of the plane. If,
right.
if this whole movie's a dream, it means that he died in his plane, and
right.
everything after that is a dream. And the filmmakers, Powell and Pressburger, seem to, I think, be hinting at something where you mentioned all the statues of, like, Aristotle and Benjamin Franklin and all these,
right.
you know, these statues of these great people that line the steps of this giant stairwell. I looked this up as I was doing research for this episode. Every single one of the historical figures pictured, it was famous for having epilepsy.
Oh,
are
okay.
they suggesting that this is what Peter is suffering from, and this
right.
is all a fantasy in his mind? I mean, I think that they're – I mean, Powell and Pressburger seem to really be charmed by this whole story. So I believe this is really happening.
Yes, I do too.
It just seems very cynical read to say it's – oh, no, it's all the dream of a dead guy. That doesn't seem to be the speed of these two guys because, as you mentioned, the whole bit about Kim Hunter sacrificing herself. First of all, Kim Hunter making her third appearance on the Film and Water podcast so far.
Really? Yeah.
We did The Seventh Victim. She was in that. Okay. And we did Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes, of course, yes.
She's terrific in this movie. She is guileless. She's wonderful. She has a great chemistry with David Niven.
Oh, absolutely.
They are great together. And
just on when they're talking in the plane. When they're in the very beginning of the movie,
it's like
you know they're in love. It's like you could just feel it, you know? And they're not even together. I mean, he's in the plane, ready to jump out and die, and she's trying to, you know, figure something out. And you could tell the chemistry, you know, right there.
Yeah, she doesn't want to admit to him that she knows he's going to die.
Right.
He has that kind of British stiff upper lip thing. Well, I guess I'm Jerry'd. Oh, well, you know, he's kind of like, what are you going to do? I mean, they really are terrific together. And, you know, Powell and Pressburger, not only on an acting level, I think on a physical level, really put their actors through their paces. Because you mentioned the ping pong game.
Right.
And the ping pong game between Kim Hunter and Roger Livesley, they freeze in the middle of it. Because that's when the angel comes down. And there were several scenes where all the actors have to freeze. And then you have one actor moving in between the rest of the actors. Which means it was not done. I mean, there was no way to do it with visual trickery because the actor, you've got David Niven moving behind other actors, in front of other actors. So these people are literally just frozen. And the first time I saw this movie, I just rented it, you know, from a video store that I worked at, just sort of a blind, what's this movie? This looks interesting. That first scene where they freeze the ping pong game, my head started to hurt because it was so it was so unforced and so natural the way they're just cuck, 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 and then
and
they
then
just
stop
and you're like, I was like, wait, what's happening? Like, you know, did the tape stop? I don't understand. I mean, these guys, Powell and Pressburger, really used their. I mean, one of the things again I was impressed by these two guys is they really respect their audience. They do handhold you through these any of their movies, but this one, I mean, they just. The switching between back and forth of heaven and the you know, England and then the color and the black and white is so rapid and so back and forth and so unforced and unceremonious that it really is amazing. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that viewfinder that the doctor has.
That's cool. I'd love something like that.
For all you comic nerds listening to this, the comparison I can make is think of the viewfinder that all the heroes had in Kingdom Come, where they're in, like, the Green Lantern satellite and they're looking down at Earth. That's what this is just a guy in England in 1946 that has this thing.
Yes.
And like, what a contraption to have. Like, this is an amazing bit of visual invention on these guys' parts. In this movie, considering it's so earthbound in so many ways, it is one of, to me, like an amazing fantasy epic because it looks, it's so vast and so un, it looks like a Terry Gilliam movie 40 years before Terry Gilliam ever thought of doing stuff like
exactly. that. It's just the way it's filmed, like you said, like, you know, they go up to heaven. And, you know, you don't see all these angels flying around necessarily. You don't see all these clouds.
All the new dead people get wings in a plastic bag.
Yeah,
like it's in a laundry.
They each get wings as they come through. And yet it's still so fantastic, you know? It's so – just the way it just looks fantastic. And, you know, it looks like fantasy, even though it's just, you know, a black and white scene of people – you know, lining up and coming in. And like I said, you know, like, like when I said they were looking down through the big circles and there's like almost like a halo of light coming down, you know, it just makes it look so amazing, you know? I mean, just going, and like you said, going from the black and white to the color, it just seamlessly just went, it's like you barely know. I mean, you notice, of course, because the Technicolor is beautiful. But you accept this, you know. It's not like, well, this doesn't seem, you know, realistic or this. It makes sense the way it's done.
Yeah, I mean, you met the scene. There's the one scene in the doctor's sort of office where it's kind of like at dawn or something, and the room that Kim Hunter is in with the doctor is darkness, and then he right. opens the window, and this yellow light just comes in and bathes the scene, and all of a sudden it's just black and yellow, and it is startling, and it's so beautiful to look at. I mean, it's like I said, it really took my breath away when I first saw it, because you're just like, I've never seen movies that looked like this. It just doesn't look, it looks otherworldly, even though we're back down on Earth. It's just remarkable. I mean, I wish I could find something more high-minded to say about it, other than it really is sumptuous. It's so beautiful.
It is. I mean, when I first saw it, I was a kid, like I said, I was 10 years old, I think, when I first saw it. And I remember just looking at this movie and saying, you know, this is just, I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
And I remember years later, I hadn't seen the movie for years, and maybe it was on TCM or something. So, God, I have to watch this movie. And I just, you know, fell in love with this film. It is just, you know, it's magic. It's just everything about it is just from, you know, right from the beginning to the ending. It's like, you know, we're just following this plot right along. And everything, you know, everything in between that just might be mundane or something, it isn't mundane. It's like you said, when he opens the drapes, you know, I mean, that should be, oh, okay, well, the room is, you know, now light. No, it's beautiful to look at. And they just, it's like they, you know, they went over every frame, every just, you know, to make sure that this movie was just, you know, was a fantasy, even though we, you know, we're not 100% sure whether he's actually, you know, imagining this or it's actually happening. And they didn't use, you know, like you're talking about, you know, the stop, you know, when they stop and all of that. They didn't really use special effects.
The actors just stopped moving.
They just stopped. I mean, they're playing the ping pong and that's it. You know, and it's just the discipline of the actors just standing there. I remember when they come down to get Peter, and he comes off of the operating table, and they're all frozen around him, you know. And, you know, he just gets up and walks out. And, you know, I was like, the discipline of the actors of just being able to freeze for that length of time. And I'm sure they stopped and you know, went back and refilmed certain things, but it's just amazing the way they do this. It's really like it's literally like he's just walking around and then everybody's literally frozen, and you could, you know, you try to look hard to see if you could see movement, you know.
Yeah.
When you see something like that, to see if you could see movement, but you really can't.
Yeah.
You really can't. It's just, you know, the way this was done, it was just really amazing.
There's a real, despite all the death in this movie, and there is a lot of death, you know, I mean, it's about war. This movie has a real joy to it, and, you know, movies that feature characters going to heaven can get really sickeningly, you know, overdone, you know, can just be way too twee with people on clouds and harps and all this stuff. And
silly, you know?
Silly, that's even a better word. It's very, you know, silly. This movie manages to just straddle that edge where it feels like, you know what? Like, I could almost picture heaven being like this. It's like a big subway station. And, you know, we're going to give people, like, we're going to give a bunch of GIs Cokes to relax them because we're there.
Right.
Thing. I mean, the famous director Richard Attenborough, who of course started his career as an actor.
Yeah, he was in it. I can't find him though.
He's in this movie. He has one line. He just has the one line. He comes in, he doesn't say anything, and then there's later on, he has just the one line. But I mean, he went on, of course, to become.
To be.
Cloned a bunch of dinosaurs. I mean,
that too.
Yeah. But I mean,
but he was an incredible director, you know, and then he was an actor as well. So.
Yep.
Of course, we know him as, you know, the dinosaur clone man. But
I mean, I think it's like for actors, you probably really got comfortable with how Powell and Pressburger worked And if you didn't, you were probably really screwed. But if you gave yourself over to it, and all these actors
right.
really seem to just fit into it perfectly, where, like I said, they straddle that line between being too silly, too ridiculous, but also heartfelt and kind of, you know, just kind of guileless. And I think a lot of their other films are like that. They have another one called I Know Where I'm Going, which is very sweetly and romantic. And that movie is of a similar kind of tone. And they managed to capture this very particular tone. And across all their films, I've only seen a handful of their movies. I've seen I Know Where I'm Going, and I've seen Black Narcissus. And, you know, this one's my favorite because it's just, it is just, again, I'm repeating ourselves, but it really is unlike anything you've ever seen. It really is.
It just doesn't, and
this is, I want to mention this little factoid. This is J.K. Rowling's favorite movie.
Really? Yes. That I didn't know.
Yeah. And, you know, you could sort of, you know, I'm trying to, you know, you could picture, she probably saw this on television when she was a young girl. And, you know, when you've seen of Harry Potter, you can see why she loves this movie. You know,
it's sure.
fit in that aesthetic perfectly.
Absolutely. You know, and, you know, like you said, the movie's about death, and yet everybody seems to be enjoying themselves.
Yeah, it's
you know,
good.
I mean, it's so natural. It's like, oh, I'm dead. Okay, I come down. We gotta go bring him to heaven, and you know, it's very natural. You know, and like you said, you could picture heaven being this way. It'd be nice if it was this way.
It would be nice. All your needs are taken care of. You're given your angel wings in the plastic bag. You're ready to go.
Right.
It's good. It's good. It really is a really remarkable movie. And the last thing that I want to mention about it is apparently, I did some research here, there were numerous radio adaptations, which is confounding to me because this film is so visual.
It's so visual.
I can't picture how this works just as an audio form, but I want to track some of them down just to hear what it sounds like because, you know, these guys work so hard on their visuals. It's remarkable.
It's a great story. So, yeah, you know, fine. You know, listening to it, I'm sure it's fine, but this is like one of the most visual movies I've ever seen, you know, to really, you have to see the movie to just listen to it on the radio. You're going to lose everything that these guys try to do here.
Yeah.
And just one last thing, you know, it's funny because they've made such great movies and they're, you know, in the film world and, you know, some guys like us, we know this movie and we know, Pressburger and, Powell, but They're not that well known, you know. I mean, everybody knows The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind and Casablanca and all these, you know, great classics. But these movies are classics as well. And, you know, again, like you said, Martin Scorsese and all, you know, these people, they're aware of you know, the two of Pressburger and Powell. But not everybody is. I mean, you know, you go on the street and say, well, name a classic movie. Nobody's going to name this movie.
No.
You know? And I just wish they got, hopefully, if anyone does listen to this, I hope that they look for this movie, and I hope they look for the other their other movies as well, because they were just absolutely brilliant, brilliant filmmakers.
Yeah. This movie is not the easiest one to find. It's not available on iTunes or anything for rent.
No.
But it is absolutely worth checking out and tracking down. You can get it. It's on Criterion, I believe. It is on DVD, and I don't know if it's on Blu-ray, but it is on DVD.
Right.
It is absolutely worth checking out, and it is the kind of movie that I would really say, if you watch it, like, don't put your phone down. Put it in, you know, put it in your pocket. Pay attention. Just sit and watch this movie, and it's only about an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's not long. It's not long at all.
Yeah,
and you know, just keep your eye. Don't blink. I mean, you want to see every second of this film, every shadow, every movement, everything, because you don't want to miss it.
That's absolutely true. And like I said, I'm really glad we got to talk about it because I love, you know, the show likes to cover all the different kinds of movies, and we've been covering some big stuff, some small stuff. But when this was on your list, it just jumped out at me. I was like, oh, my God, someone else has actually seen this movie? So that's great. So
yes.
I really appreciate you giving me a reason to watch this movie again and having a chance to talk about it and maybe introduce it to some new people. So, Mark,
thank
you so much for this, man. And thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime.
All right. Well, and you're on Twitter, right? So where can people find you?
Well, I am on Twitter. I'm at, I think it's at Mark Mark Lacks won, I think. And easy enough. At Mark Lacks, put Mark Lacks in, you're going to find it.
There you go.
And of course, on Facebook.
All right. Yeah, and we'll have your Twitter link in the show notes as well. So, again, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. This is a really terrific movie, as are virtually all the Powell and Pressburg movies. And this is – I want to do more of this because their filmography is worth rediscovering, at least discovering
for
the show.
Yes, absolutely.
It's amazing, amazing stuff. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Of course, you can find the show over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod, and this and all of our other episodes are on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So thanks for listening, and until next week, that's a wrap.
A Matter of Life and Death was Michael Powell's favorite film. Emmerich Pressburger's favorite was The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, starring Roger Livesey, who you will see tonight playing Dr. Reeves. Amolad, which is what we call this film for short, was Michael's favorite film because he could be a magician, he could create heaven and earth, he could make time stand still, he could let his imagination flourish. But it was also his favorite because it embodies his unique way of looking at life. Michael had no fear of death himself. He considered it a continuum of life. Michael wanted to show in this film that love often involves sacrifice, and that sacrifice is about love. He thought children should have pets from a very early age so that they would learn having a pet is more about a loving, bouncy, adorable puppy. It's about feeding, walking, and caring for it. So today, when you see Kim Hunter make a very important decision that involves stepping on a stairway, Michael Powell's attitude about life is clearly demonstrated there. He would have made that sacrifice for me, and I would have made it for him. Note the calm way that people accept death in this film if it is a gift from one person to another. Watch David Niven being given some shocking news in an ambulance and see the way he understands and accepts it. I have always been staggered by how the Archers made this part of their film. And when the wonderful Roger Livesey arrives in heaven, he is enjoying himself immensely, talking enthusiastically to the 17th century John Bunyan, a poet he has always admired, and is thrilled to be able to actually meet. Many years later, when David Niven died after a long illness, Michael asked me to send a telegram to his family, which said, "Good luck up that stairway, chum." Very typical Michael Powell. When American distributors wanted to change the title of this film from A Matter of Life and Death to Stairway to Heaven because they didn't think American audiences would go see a film with death in the title, Michael and Emmerich were very upset. They said, "But we have all of us just survived a war with the greatest and most fanatical power in the world and won it. In the last 12 years, 16 million human lives have been sacrificed to overthrow one man and his lunatic ideas. The words life and death are just facts. We are trying to create a comedy about two worlds fighting for one man's life. It is indeed a matter of life and death." But the Americans weren't persuaded. Michael Powell always told Martin Scorsese and me to never do what they had done, underestimate their audience in this way, to always know that they are ahead of us and that that we must struggle as filmmakers to get ahead of them. So the decision was very disappointing. However, the real title of the film came in very handy when Martin Scorsese and I were trying to get the Rank organization in England to help with the resurrection of the Powell Pressburger films, and I was having trouble getting through to the higher-ups. But when a secretary asked me why I wanted to talk to the executive, and I said, "It's about a matter of life and death," she said, "Oh, good heavens, I'm so sorry, I'll put you right through." It didn't help, but anyway. See what you think of Michael and Emmerich's film, and my deepest thanks to Turner Classic Movies for letting me celebrate the work of Powell and Pressburger here. Thank you.